Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. Today we hear a past interview with Russ Gerst about the life of Eugene Maloff, who wrote the book Fire from Ice, Searching for the Truth Behind the Cold Fusion Fuhrer. Russ is a colleague of Dr. Judy Wood and a researcher of free energy. Last night's presentation at the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington, Long Island, discussing weather control and geoengineering went really well. It was a great turnout. Wonderful to see the strength of that community and the interest in these topics and the larger picture of geoengineering, genetically modified food, disaster capitalism, and the activism going forward. Big thank you to Brian Benz and Charlotte Sky, one of the founders of the Cinema Arts Center. We hear an excerpt from Cindy Pakulis' presentation from last night at the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington, Long Island. Let's have a listen.
So what's happening? Climate change, Arctic methane release, which is happening, and they're starting to talk about that in the news, and if it happens, it's going to be devastating. Ocean acidification, bee die-off, bat die-off, the tornadoes, sixth grade extinction. I think we're losing something like 200 species a day. Earthquakes, the middle of the country is the new dust bowl. They're having dust storms now, I believe, like they are in the Mideast. So, I mean, crazy things are happening. But global warming stopped 16 years ago. So what's going on? Our planet hasn't warmed in approximately 16 years. Here's another one. Climate change controversy, how science can get very political. This is a scientist who says that the warming of the planet stopped 16 years ago, along with when they outlawed the chlorofluorocarbons. So it was that was warming the planet. And the Antarctic sea ice is increasing despite models and predictions. So the Arctic is decreasing, but the Antarctic is increasing as you have floods somewhere, droughts elsewhere. And it's really interesting because in the Arctic, every government on the planet has ships up there because it's opening up. And underneath the Arctic are these great reserves of oil. So that's quite convenient. And I was also going to put up, because I have a bunch of patents up here, I was going to put up a patent about the nanomaterials that they're using in the sky. And one of the nanomaterials actually can go directly where the geoengineers want it to go. So if they drop the clouds in the sky, the trails, the particles in there can gravitate to the Arctic if that's where they desire. And this is by David Keith, and he's one of the big honchos. He's received a lot of money from Bill Gates, but he's one of the big proponents of geoengineering. So they can actually make the particles go where they want it to go. And even NASA is kind of in a little bit of a conundrum now because they're finding out that carbon in the upper atmosphere is actually reflecting the light back, is protecting us from the solar radiation of the sun. So how can it be such a bad guy? And I'm not disputing at all that carbon can actually warm the planet and that it's creating a greenhouse gas. My problem is that there's obviously an elephant in the room when they're dropping all these particles and our climate is changing. And no one is discussing this and they're doing it behind our back. So I don't even discuss global warming. I just try to bring up the inaccuracies of everything that is thrown at us in the print that you don't know who to believe or what is actually true until you start doing your own investigation and then it all actually starts to become very clear. So who could do this? Well, even before I get to this, let's talk about what they did in the subways this weekend. They released a gas, okay? And of course, the gas is supposed to be okay. But when you dig a little deeper, you find out that they're not really sure if it's such a safe gas, that it might have some side effects. Well, that's great. Being that all of our immune systems are compromised from being sprayed on every day, how many people are actually going to get sick from riding the F train this weekend? And how many people, I know a lot of activists, you know, sent letters to their legislators and did whatever they could to get it stopped, but it didn't get stopped. So let's talk about it. In 1943, the Navy tested mustard gas on its own sailors. 1956 to 1961 were MK Ultra, where they gave LSD to unsuspecting people. 1950, the Army secretly used a Navy ship cruising outside the Golden Gate to spray supposedly harmless bacteria over the city, but I believe two people, or one of them died, and many people were sickened. For three decades after World War II, the nuclear industry exposed civilians to radiation in concentrations far above what is considered normal. In the 60s, the military secret experiment sprayed zinc, cadmium, sulfide, and possibly radiation on low-income housing from planes. And they also actually put some of these canisters or whatever they used to spray it on top of buildings by schools. A reporter broke that story last year. So how do they do this? And I know Michael touched on HAARP, and I'm just going to touch on a little bit about HAARP because we're going to start getting into the companies that could benefit from this. It's high-frequency active auroral research program, and the construction started in 1990. And that's a pretty picture of HAARP. It has something like, I think it's 180 antennas that actually act as one beam. And this isn't the only HAARP in the world. We have actually quite a few, as does every other country on the planet. And we even have floating HAARPs, and Jeff Brady's going to talk a little bit more about this when he comes up. So what is HAARP? It's an electrically charged shield protecting the Earth from solar radiation. That's what it's aiming at, the ionosphere. In 1912, Nikola Tesla developed alternating current, and he thought that he could create shields to protect the Earth, and he actually even said he could probably split the Earth using the ionosphere. Bernard Eastland applied for patents to bring these ideas to fruition. And he actually created, I think it's something like 11 patents, but we're going to focus on the three. And it was to deflect missiles, to alter the weather, and to lift the ionosphere. ARCO was the original owner of these patents. So we're going to start talking a little bit about some big names. The Rockefeller family owned ARCO. When Standard Oil was split up, it was split up into seven oil companies, and they were called the sisters. So this was one of the sisters. And ARCO was the original owner of these patents, and ARCO was actually the original owner of building HAARP with the Navy, with the Air Force, with DARPA. And then Congress directed the Defense Department to explore the auroral regions in Alaska of the ionosphere to improve communication and surveillance systems, which we're all hearing tons about. I think they pretty much got it down pat. And the Navy and the Air Force managed the program. And applications included destroying missiles, communications, disruption, and modifying the weather, and what I'm going to focus a little bit more on, lifting a portion of the ionosphere out into space to deflect missiles. So basically, one of the main things about HAARP was they wanted to be able to maneuver the ionosphere. So how does it work? All of the antennas act as one, and they shoot. The energy HAARP beams into the atmosphere, heats up the ionosphere, and pushes it out into space. But what they do is they direct it at a piece of the ionosphere, and from there they can direct it basically wherever they want. Mm-hmm. And if you go online and on YouTube, there are some amazing documentaries. You can even access them from our website, The World According to HAARP. Angels Don't Play That HAARP. Yes? It's the natural wavelengths that when the energy from the sun hits the atmosphere in Alaska, it creates the auroral. And I'm glad you brought that. It's called the auroral, but it's different wavelengths on how it's reflected in the ionosphere. And that has been moving downward. In fact, last year, I think they were able to see parts of it upstate in Rochester. So it's kind of, they've been moving that around too, where that has never happened before. Okay, so they beam the energy up into the atmosphere, and if you notice, I keep saying this could indirectly affect the jet stream as the ionosphere is pushed out into space, dragging the stratosphere below up and pulling the jet stream up as well. The result changes the way water moves through our atmosphere, and our entire climate is based on water because up in the atmosphere, it really is just rivers of water. So once you can control that, you can control the climate. So here's one of the patents that's pretty important. Method and apparatus for altering a region in the Earth's atmosphere, ionosphere, and or magnetosphere. It's from 1985, and it's Bernard Eastland. So that basically gave the United States government, well, really ARCO, who was owned by the Rockefellers, total ownership over the ionosphere. So how did chemtrails add? Well, chemtrails is really a multi-level project. This is just one area that it really focuses a lot of its attention on. But if you start doing a lot of research, you'll find out that chemtrails actually serves many purposes. So as planes release metal oxides into the air, HART heats up those oxides, thus heating up the atmosphere. This prevents the gathering of water vapor that would otherwise turn into clouds. No clouds means no rain, hence we have the drought in the middle of the country. California is experiencing huge water shortages. No clouds means no rain, and I'm going to coin a word from Dane Wigington, formless clouds. And I just want to spend a moment talking about that because I talked a little bit about I don't tell people to look for the lines anymore. I tell them to look for the sun. And I also, like I said, tell them to find a real cloud. The stuff that we're seeing in our atmosphere are not clouds. It was in the paper this weekend. They want to name the first new cloud that they've had. I think it's Aspergicus. I can't even say the name. A new cloud that they haven't named a cloud in 50 years. Of course not, because for the last 50 years they've been creating new clouds. So now people are noticing, what is this? So now they're actually putting out bids to name this new cloud. So let's talk about what else HARP can do. HARP can trigger catastrophic earthquakes, because all you have to do is face it at the ionosphere and it reflects down, and if it hits a fault, there you go. If you do any sort of earthquake monitoring, you'll notice that we are having a ton of earthquakes every day. Just like we're having huge solar flares, we are having so many earthquakes continuously. I don't trust an earthquake anymore. Every time there's a major earthquake, my first question is, who stands to gain? Because let's talk a little bit about hurricanes and how much they've changed, as we know from Sandy and the devastation that it did to Long Island and the devastation that it did all along the coastline. Okay, because it was all along the coastline that that hurricane did horrific damage. It wasn't just here, and we suffered tremendously. On August 23rd, scientists monitored a small storm in the Bahamas. And at that point, it was called Tropical Depression 12. It wasn't expected to do anything, but then it started to do some really weird stuff. Days later, it became a Category 5. It was moving at 175 miles per hour. They didn't expect it to hit shore, but it did a 90-degree turn. How can a hurricane do a 90-degree turn? And she was moving in a straight line. Up until the last couple of years, hurricanes were not capable of doing that. Sandy did the same thing, too. As it reached Philadelphia, it did a 90-degree turn and came in and hit us and hit Boston and went through and devastated that part of the country. The tornadoes. I have a little thing coming up on the tornadoes. The tornadoes, they're even talking about making a new category, F6 tornadoes, because they stay on the ground now for a half hour. And one of the ones, I think it was in Idaho, actually went backwards. Forest fires. We are having one of the worst years for forest fires. Colorado had the worst forest fire. There are fires outside of Las Vegas right now that is just burning up Las Vegas. They are everywhere. Firemen are talking about how they're hotter than ever before. They don't understand it. Well, aluminum is one of the most flammable substances on the planet. And when you're dropping tons of aluminum and you're drying out the forest, forget it. We're having forest fire alerts on our weather program now. I don't know how many of you get it from the Weather Channel. Bleep, oh, fire. I don't know whether it's going to be a fire, a tornado, or a hurricane. This is not new. We are all just, and I believe it was Rosalind Peterson noticed it in 1988, Cliff Carnegie, 1988. I have a yoga tape at home that's from like 1990 or 1989. There are trails. It's in Arizona. There are trails everywhere. You just watch them obliterate the sky. Look in any old movie, The Philadelphia Story, 1980. The sky is devastated. And they go back and they put other things in. Okay, so this was 1966. The Federal Council, Herbert Chairman, asked to find out about the weather modification programs that were happening to the president. A couple of years after that meeting, 1975, a patent, how do we make contrails? And then another patent in 1977, combustible compositions for generating aerosols. So they've had these patents and their ownership forever. And then they put out in 1990 a companion, which Michael, I believe, reference to the HARP document by the Air Force, owning the weather and what they were going to do with the ionosphere so that they can control the weather. I think they've gotten their goal. And there is, if you Google online, you can read the whole document. And it's quite intense, and it actually is quite scary because it brings in all the drones and all the robotic mosquitoes that are flying around that can take pictures of us. It really is, it really lets you know, whether or not it's true or a plant, either way, you get a lot of information from it. Okay, so to repeat, how does HAARP work? It pulls the ionosphere out into space. It can lift it. It can do all those things to it. And then, of course, you get all of this information. This is from 2008, where climatologists are talking about how the jet stream, which is in the stratosphere under the ionosphere, is being pulled and is starting to act in all crazy ways. And here's another one. As the jet stream moved north, moist air barreled into the plains, those horrific tornadoes we just experienced. And one meteorologist said the jet stream was stuck in place. It kept funneling cool air down. I've never seen anything like this. So even meteorologists are looking at it. They're not really asking why, but they're looking at what's going on. And then here, extreme weather. This was just printed the other day, tied to unusual jet stream. The jet stream usually rushes rapidly from west to east in a mostly straight direction, but lately it's been wobbling and weaving like a drunken driver, wreaking havoc. This is a meteorologist. If they're not asking questions, we have to ask questions because they're not asking questions. This is crazy. They're not looking at why. They're saying it might have to do with global warming, but they can't even say that that's it. So, and now the bad news. Before we go on, it's only fair that I tell you that weather modification is legal, and it's been legal since the 70s. They're not doing anything wrong as long as we consent. They can do whatever they want, and that's exactly what they're doing, whatever they want.
That was Cindy Pakulis. She's the director of Long Island Skywatch, an educator who has done extensive research exposing who is behind some of the geoengineering operations. Dr. Judy Wood's groundbreaking book titled Where Did the Towers Go? Evidence of Directed Free Energy on 9/11 gathers amazing evidence revealing how the Twin Towers turned to dust in the air using energy waves directed in a way that they would interfere in particular zones. The subtitle of Dr. Wood's book, Evidence of Directed Free Energy Technology on 9/11, is an invitation to the reader to find out more about free energy, especially the type used during 9/11. Many researchers say this directed free energy technology is now weaponized and in the wrong hands. Further research into this realm is often eclipsed by the discussion of the towers collapsing or disintegrating. Dr. Wood has given the reader plenty of evidence revealing the free energy signature left at ground zero. Dr. Wood references the science of cold fusion, or more accurately termed transmutation, from the artifact remains from the destruction of the towers, such as bent beams, slow bending of metals, and melting without heat. She also references looking at the cold fusion story and suggests the book Fire from Ice, Searching for the Truth in the Cold Fusion Führer by Dr. Eugene Maloff. We talk today with Russ Gerst. He's a CPA, and he's also worked with Dr. Wood to help publish her book. He's knowledgeable about the effort to cover up the science of free energy and some of the players that are involved up until today within the 9/11 truth movement. But we're also going to get a behind-the-scenes look at the nature of cover-up and an insight into Dr. Wood's timeline of investigation. Russ, welcome to the show.
Hey, great to be here.
Excellent. Well, we should start by reminding listeners what is cold fusion, and Dr. Wood's more accurately says it's transmutation. But can you tell listeners a little bit about that?
Well, what Pons and Fleischmann kind of discussed or discovered back in 1989, and actually they had discovered it back in about 1984 or thereabouts, but what they found was that though it was like a nuclear reaction, it wasn't typical to like your hydrogen bomb or in particular more your fission bombs where you've got high volumes of radiation, like your gamma rays and such. And what you do have more of is energy output, but you do have small signatures such as tritium production, just in trace amounts, but definitely above background, what occurs in nature. So you do have that, and what they also found was that there is creation of other elemental forms that is coming maybe from the metal lattice, because what they found in their cold fusion, they were actually using anode and cathode of platinum and palladium. And the palladium, when you run an electric current through the water, it actually superpacks this deuterium, which is a heavy form of hydrogen, into the metal lattice. And inside that metal lattice, you're getting transmutations of metal from the palladium into other things. And it creates kind of a distribution of what types of metals are actually created in this process. And there's evidently that type of thing going on in that discovery.
Breaking it down a little further, too, in Fire from Ice, Eugene Malov mentions, and so does Dr. Wood, is it's changing at the nuclear level. I guess the protons are changing. Maybe one is added or one is taken away, which might change something from copper to gold or iron,
right,
or something like that. Very different from the chemical, I guess, exchange, which a lot of people are saying, the critics often had mentioned about cold fusion that there was a chemical reaction and not a nuclear reaction. Could you explain a little bit about that?
Well, the reason why Pons and Fleischmann came forward and said that it had to be nuclear was, you know, chemical reactions do release amounts of energy depending on the type of reaction there was. And, you know, over time, chemists have been able to record the amounts of energy that are generated in reactions of various types, of all different types of elements with other elements, etc. And when they actually did their work with the palladium and the heavy hydrogen, they were getting factors of 10 more energy output than any chemical reaction that they were aware of. And that, I'm talking like maybe 4 to 5 times, or maybe even 10 to more times, actual energy output than any chemical reaction that they had ever. And I mean, these were leading chemists in their field. These weren't, you know, some guy that's mixing stuff in their garage. These guys had been well written. You know, they had written many, many, many papers. You know, they were at the top of their field. One was at Cambridge, the other one was at the University of Utah, and was fairly young. Mr. Pons, Stanley Pons, was actually only in the department for a few years, and he was already the department head of their chemistry department, and had studied under Martin Fleischmann over in England. So these folks were very well-respected chemists, and they knew their craft very well. They knew that nothing that they had ever experienced or had ever seen documented created the volume of energy that they were seeing.
Right. And there was measurable heat, I understand, as well, that they could point out. Interestingly, Russ, in the book, I'm very new to, I heard about cold fusion when it started. I remember hearing about it. But I also remember, just on the periphery, that it didn't work, and that's what the media was saying, it didn't work. However, reading this book, it was interesting to me that once the experiment was done and there was measurable output to theorize or say that this experiment did yield something beyond the break-even point, no one else, and not even Pons and Fleischmann, were able to reproduce that again. Is that accurate to say?
Well, no. Actually, Pons and Fleischmann had repeated it a number of times. The problem that they ran into was that the metal preparation for the palladium sometimes is inconsistent, and what they found was it was very difficult to repeat it because they didn't know exactly what it was about how that metal was prepared that specifically made sure that it would create the effect every time. Now, researchers since that time have gotten much better at it. They're still not perfect. I think some of them are up to about 70%. But a fallacy of science is that because you can't recreate it every time, doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And a good case in point is back when they were trying to clone animals. You know, they thought they could, and they kept trying. Well, finally, they got a positive result where they actually cloned an exact duplicate of an animal from cells from its body. It took them hundreds of times, and then, you know, after that, it took them hundreds more times before they could begin to replicate it consistently. And part of the difficulty with what was going on was they didn't know why specifically it worked, so it made it more difficult to recreate it. But the other thing that a lot of people found, and it's documented in Malow's book, mm-hmm. was that there were a lot of people that had a lot at stake in other forms of fusion research, like the hot fusion tokamaks and that sort of thing, and they had millions to billions of dollars riding on continuing to work on that research.
That's nuclear energy, essentially.
Right. That was what they called hot fusion. And what they would do is they would falsify their results. And Malov went back and started researching what MIT had done, because MIT had their own tokamak reactor, and they were pulling in millions of dollars a year for their research projects. And they had actually lowered their results so that it looked like they were not achieving overunity. And overunity is basically when you're actually producing more energy than what you're putting in.
Overunity, that's what it's called.
I think that's what they call it in the jargon of nuclear science, and when they're trying to actually achieve more energy output than what they're putting in.
When did you learn of cold fusion? And you mentioned the 60 Minutes interview in a prior conversation. Was that when you heard about it?
No, I heard about it it was probably about 2006. The 60 Minutes interview was actually in 2009. In 2006, there was kind of a major split in the so-called truth movement. And those researchers who were supposedly and academics who were actually out there looking into the goings-on with the 9/11 fiasco at Ground Zero, it came to my attention that Stephen Jones had been involved in what had transpired back in 1989. So in starting to research some of that, I watched a video called Heavy Watergate that kind of talked about what happened with Pons and Fleischmann and who the players were. Well, the main one they noted was Stephen Jones. So I thought, well, I'll do some more looking up into this. And the Malov book was the best source, not so much for talking about the science of it as talking about what transpired.
It's a fantastic read. It's yeah. I've got it. Maybe 40% through, but I did start to read about Dr. Stephen Jones and his work and how he got grants from the Department of Energy to work on a version of cold fusion. It was called something else.
Well, and that's the thing. Cold fusion is really kind of a misnomer. He was working, you know, back in the mid-80s. He had actually worked on a piece of research that dealt with what they called muon-catalyzed fusion, where you actually had subatomic particles called muons. And again, I'm no expert on this, but that research never did, you know, come forward and go over unity. Yes, they did get some energy heat output that was beyond what was input, but it was never, you know, substantially much that it ever went anywhere. It was just, you know, good to know stuff. This is the kind of thing that can happen. But in the late 80s, he's changed what his research was, and part of it kind of centered on some research grants that Pons and Fleischmann had applied for through the DOE, meaning the Department of Energy. What he did was he was asked to review the research grant by a gentleman in the DOE. And here at the same time, he was actually doing similar experimentations. And it's not clear why he all of a sudden got into electrolysis, but it makes you wonder if, you know, seeing what they were doing made him get involved in that. And all of a sudden they were competing rather than one doing muon-catalyzed fusion and the others doing electrolytic analysis.
It's a very interesting thing, Restjit, but just to clear, they meaning Fleischmann and Pons application, right?
Right.
Okay.
Right. And it starts you wondering, you know, and Malov couldn't be clear on it because he was so close to it in proximity to time. He was more just talking about what was known at the time, but it becomes kind of suspicious that all of a sudden Stephen Jones started doing electrolysis and electrolytic work versus doing the, you know, the more heavy physics-laden muon catalyzed type fusion, where you're actually using more of the things that, that physicists use in trying to create fusion reactions.
We're speaking with Russ Gerst about the life of Eugene Malov and his book Fire from Ice. We'll be right back after this break. Just joining us, we're listening to a past interview with Russ Gerst, talking about the life of Eugene Malov and cold fusion. I understand that, I think, which means you're more or less slamming atoms and things like that together.
Right, right. You're using particle accelerators and that sort of thing. And I mean, he did have access to that because he was actually working with the Los Alamos laboratories, and he was working with folks, I believe, out at Caltech. And that's an interesting connection there as well.
I don't understand it completely, but Stephen Jones and Pons and Fleischmann had, at the same time, were doing press conferences and press releases and really competing with each other on a really passive aggressive level. But Stephen Jones, he was very critical of Fleischmann and Pons as well. What was going on there afterward? What do you suspect is happening?
During the time that all of this was occurring, Jones kind of made it sound like he was just trying to work with Fleischmann and Pons. But what happened was there was concern because both they were in different research universities. One was with BYU and Jones, and Pons and Fleischmann were representing the University of Utah. And, you know, they were looking at getting patents on the technology, and so Pons and Fleischmann, in fear that they might lose that for their university and all the research grant money that would come with that, they felt like they had to go public with it, even though they said 18 months at a minimum before the day in March that they actually went public. And at that point, that's when Jones became subversively adversarial and started forcing their hand. And, you know, down the road by, I think it was early May, he gave a presentation at the American Physical Society, which is basically all physicists. And he said, you know, who believes that these guys could possibly be right? Raise your hand. And unfortunately, that's not scientific at all. That's just a poll.
And not a sign. Go ahead.
He stirred up a lot of misinformation on what was going on. He did it with a very straight face. And that's what Malov described in the book, was that, you know, he kind of merged together how innocent and Boy Scoutish he appeared with some of the other actions that he actually took. And it was just amazing how, you know, it was just kind of subversive things that he would do. And then all of a sudden he'd kind of crack the whip, and he did that at the American Physical Society.
He was a Mormon, I understand, mm-hmm. A member of the Church of the Latter-day Saints in Utah. Again, we didn't mention this, but he was at Brigham Young University in Utah. Fast forward to 2006, 2009. I guess in that realm, he is involved in the 9/11 truth movement. We'll get to that point a little bit later. But other people, such as John Bockris at Texas A&M, reproduced on some level the Pons-Fleischmann cold fusion transmutation experiment. How accurate was that reproduction?
Well, there were people that still continued to say that their instrumentation must have been wrong. Their recordings must have been incorrect. But as time went by, and you know, all the way up into the 2000s, you know, there were a number of people, particularly chemists. I mean, mostly chemists, who were doing the experimentation, and what they found was that it took them tremendous amounts of time, partly because they didn't know specifically why the preparation had to be as it was to get the reaction. But it would take them, you know, long periods of time. But what happened back in the 90s was the research as it existed at that point was tarnished so badly that no one could get any research funding for it. So the research, instead of surging forward with lots of money put toward it and lots of people working at it, it was basically shut down. No funding was given anywhere for it. If you did it, you had to do it on your own time, kind of in the closet, and hopefully not get caught, because if you were and you were at a research university, that meant you were, you know, diverting funds away from one thing to another.
A lot of the listeners of the station understand what we're talking about here, and that is the suppression of further investigating and experimenting with free energy possibilities. The research into directed free energy, a lot of that material is classified, of course, weaponized, unfortunately. There's a lot at stake for those controlling the energy resources human beings use on this planet. But what are Pons and Fleischmann doing now?
Well, they're kind of living in retirement, kind of forced retirement. They were so roundly attacked for what they had come out with that within a few years they were actually kind of forced out of their positions. They were mocked publicly to the point where they couldn't present their research because they would, you know, they would immediately be attacked for anything related to cold fusion. So I think Dr. Pons is now in France, kind of in seclusion, and Martin Fleischmann has, you know, he's been out of research. He's in his 80s now. You know, he was in his 60s at the time, and he was just kind of forced out of the type of research that he felt he could make a difference with, and that's why he felt it was so important.
Russ, let's look at the darker side of what's going on here, because there have been suspicious murders. And we'll start with Dr. Eugene Malov, author of Fire from Ice, a very important book that describes in detail the cold fusion story and the players involved. How was he murdered? What happened there?
Well, he was actually... I believe at his childhood home, his parents, I believe, had passed away, and he was at his childhood home where they had lived, and he was doing some cleaning up around the property. I don't know if they were getting ready to sell the place or whether he was just maintaining it or just what, but he was shot, I believe, in the back of the head, and it was almost execution style, you know, the type of murder that it was. I believe they did catch some people that they supposedly had murdered him, but again, it was a very shady thing, and the heck of it was, it was in 2004, and this was just before the whole 9/11 truth thing came out, and of course, you know, Dr. Stephen Jones's coming out party, and you know, over the 13 or 14 years since Fire from Ice had been created, Dr. Malov was able to learn a lot more about the behavior of Stephen Jones and how he had basically trashed what Pons and Fleischmann had done. So, you know, had he come out as the face of 9/11 truth and then started doing the same things that he did back in 1989, Malov would have been the first one to raise his hand and say, something doesn't smell right here.
And he would have been credible.
Oh, he'd have been very credible. I mean, he would have recognized exactly what was going on. So, yeah, his murder is very suspicious from that very perspective.
Russ, you formulated a very interesting timeline that revealed that wasn't the only murder involved here with people, brilliant minds researching this area of free energy. Can you describe a little bit about how you formulated that timeline and then that other murder?
another murder of an individual was to a Michael Zeber, and his name is spelled, I think it's Z-E-B-U-H-R. What's interesting about that is, one, he was a graduate student of Dr. Judy Wood. She had kind of shown him the research that she had done to this point related to 9/11 and Ground Zero. That was about the time that Jones and actually Dr. Wood were kind of butting heads over being able to share the evidence and share the research. He suddenly was killed. He was on spring break up in Minneapolis, St. Paul. Supposedly a couple of young African-American gentlemen shot him execution style, just like Eugene Malov. Well, the connection to Eugene Malov gets even better, because Michael Zeber had an uncle, William Zeber, who was actually like the assistant editor or second in command of a magazine called Infinite Energy that Eugene Malov was putting together. And they had been putting it together for many years after the whole cold fusion thing. And it actually tracked that research by those people who were still doing it. So that now all of a sudden you have the connection of Michael Zeber with Eugene Malov right there.
To some people, this is seen to send a message to those interested in researching this area of free energy, or even the title of the magazine, Infinite Energy. It may have worked, but you put that together, that timeline. Can you describe that timeline a little bit? You don't have to go into too much depth, but I think it's interesting for listeners to get a understanding of the series of events.
Well, basically the timeline gets back into who the players were back in 1989, the relation between Steve Coonan and Caltech, Crockett Graby and Caltech, related to the cold fusion fiasco, and then comes forward and says, okay, here's all the different things that transpired with the 9/11 cover-up and who the players were and, you know, what happened to them over the course of time. Now, one of the other events that actually occurred, when Dr. Wood was putting together, first she put together a request for correction with NIST so that she could be on record as having actually pointed out the problems with their reporting and the frauds that existed with what was reported upon. After she did the request for correction and it was denied, she then filed a federal KTAM whistleblower case in which she basically said that the folks that were the subcontractors for NIST, who were engineering firms, you know, the ARAs, the SAICs, Scientific Applications International Corp, these people should have known what they were seeing when they saw it. And obviously they didn't do the things that they were commissioned to do, because they never did prove how the buildings came apart. They just quit when they said collapse was initiated and it was inevitable that the buildings would come apart, and they quit. So they didn't really de-engineer anything related to that. Well, when Dr. Wood actually was in the process of filing the KTAM case, all of a sudden we had this major shooting at Virginia Tech. Now, for those people that don't know, Dr. Wood did all of her undergrad and postgraduate work at Virginia Tech. What's interesting is that where these events occurred were precisely in the dorm as well as the actual building that she attended and actually lived in. Now, there were actual professors and students in the mechanical engineering department where she actually did all of her studies that were killed in all of this. And there were also people killed in the dorm where she stayed, on the exact same floor that she actually lived on. So in retrospect, you say, well, it's coincidental, but it's like, how coincidental can it be? As I was following all of these different things that are on this timeline, I got to thinking about Crockett Graby, because he had come out as a supporter of Dr. Jones and had written numerous articles for him, and actually had written one against Dr. Wood. What he basically had been involved with back at the University of Iowa, I got to thinking about. There was a similar situation that occurred at the University of Iowa in the fall of 1991. And this was exactly 3 months to the day after his book had come out on space weapons. There was a supposed doctoral student in the physics department, which is the specific department that he was in, that went in and started shooting on a shooting rampage just exactly like Virginia Tech. And, you know, at the time that Virginia Tech occurred, it got me to thinking about what had happened at the University of Iowa, because it was exact modus operandi. You had the same, it was an Oriental, I think he was Chinese, they were both Chinese graduate students who went on a shooting rampage and supposedly killed a bunch of people. When I went back at the University of Iowa, and I thought, well, does Dr. Grabe have any connection to it? Was he a witness to it? Has he ever written on it? And as it turns out, he wrote an article 7 years after the fact for the Des Moines Register talking specifically about being right there and knowing the players that were killed in that whole situation. And he related how his father was, you know, a good friend of the, I don't know, he was like the head of the physics department that was shot and killed that day. He talked very graphically about having been a witness to this whole thing. So it's like, no, it doesn't prove that he had any specific involvement, but it sure is unusual that he could be right in the middle of something like that that is so similar to what was connected to Dr. Wood, that was maybe trying to send a message to her that she better be quiet and not continue on with what she's doing.
Russ, thank you for going through that. That's incredible work that you've done, and I really, really appreciate that. And I noticed that Dr. Wood, as far as I know, doesn't talk about any of this in public.
No, and the reason she does not is because she doesn't want to take away from her own scientific analysis of Ground Zero. She feels that stands on its own merit, and she does not need to, you know, drag this other information into it. But it's all out there, and I'm not saying that any specific person is involved in anything like that. I'm just saying the coincidences are starting to stack up to a degree where you cannot possibly imagine that they are just coincidences. It's just hard to imagine that all of these things can play out the way they did. Now, a couple other things that Dr. Grabe did, you know, within a few weeks of 9/11 happening, he wrote a specific article that said this was something just waiting to happen. Your listeners are probably familiar, back in August of 2007.
What was waiting to happen?
That, you know, there was going to be an event at Ground Zero.
Okay.
But that it wasn't what we thought. Okay? And that these buildings were, you know, they were destroyed, but they weren't destroyed by terrorists, but it was an event waiting to happen somehow. So then you fast forward to 2007 and the I-35 bridge in Minneapolis-St. Paul. Within about a week of that event occurring, he wrote an article for the Cedar Rapids Gazette saying, you know, this bridge was going to come apart. It was an event waiting to happen again. And he said that by driving over it with his car, with springs and shock absorbers and everything else, he could feel that that bridge was going to come apart. It was a broken-down bridge that needed to be fixed. Well, here's the problem with that whole premise. When you look at the video of the actual bridge, when it starts to come apart, every support, and there are like, I don't know, six on each end of the piece that went down, they all gave way at the exact same time. It wasn't like you had a weak link somewhere. It broke, the bridge started to collapse one direction, and then the other supports couldn't hold it. It didn't drop like that. Everything collapsed at the same time, and the actual deck of the bridge went straight down flat. The cars that were on it didn't even fall off.
A lot of people didn't think that was a natural event. I wanted to ask you if you had any book suggestions for listeners, if they're interested in finding out more on this thread of free energy, cold fusion?
Well, I would say, one, if the Fire from Ice book from Dr. Malov is the gold standard, because it really talks about who the players were that were involved, and it talks about how they behaved and how unnaturally they behaved as people of science. And, you know, if you're still skeptical on the connections that are loosely being made here about the other players, you have to look at it and say, would scientists really waste their time continuing to beat down something? If you went out and proved it scientifically, then you don't waste any more time with. But yet, the amount of effort that went into continuing to beat down this research, and then you fast forward and say, okay, same players are involved with Dr. Wood's work related to Ground Zero, and they're doing the same thing.
All involving free energy.
Right. And if you did an assessment of the number of articles that were written by the Stephen Jones Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice Group, if you actually go out and figure out how many articles they've written, a large percentage of their articles are pointed at Dr. Judy Wood. And it's like, you know, if her research can be debunked through scientific analysis, why would you waste your time continuing? You know, you wouldn't waste your time. You'd work on the research that proves what you're trying to prove, and that is that there was problems at Ground Zero. But they're not doing that. They're spending more time focused on her than they are doing what they're supposed to be doing. And none of their research that comes out is credible.
Really, we're looking at the cover-up of free energy, specifically cold fusion, some of the players that we've seen that weave through the same story over and over again. They pop up when these free energy ideas are publicly discussed, and we've already identified a main person. That's Dr. Stephen Jones.
Yeah, and you know, as Dr. Wood has pointed out, you know, we've had the microwave oven since the 1950s. And, I mean, that was technology that was allowed to actually, you know, be commercialized. And it's like, you know, think about all the research dollars that have been put into black projects since then. It just staggers the mind.
It is staggering. And, unfortunately, it seems at this point that, you know, a lot of this doesn't get out because of national security or whatever, protecting us. But what it's protecting us from, what is it protecting us from? Peace and free energy. But and lastly, Russ, that story that came out from Andrea Rossi's ECAT cold fusion system. So people are still working on cold fusion.
Absolutely.
And this is
yes, and you know there was the interview with Michael McCoubrey, you know, back in 2009. He's just one of a handful that have been doing it kind of on their own and scraping together whatever funding. But they're proving day in and day out that this thing works, and it's just a matter of getting enough, you know, investment dollars on the private side, which is in the open market, to make this thing work. So
it's an absolutely fascinating story and really unfortunate, but I highly recommend Fire from Ice by Eugene Malov, that book, Fire from Ice, and then Heavy Watergate. Would you recommend that, Russ?
Well, it's a wonderful video that kind of is a good primer for that, and kind of gives you a few of the names of the players. Another one, I mean, if you're really interested in the cold fusion technology, read the book by Tadahiko Mizuno, Nuclear Transmutation, The Reality of Cold Fusion. And, I mean, it's fascinating, and it's a short read. It's only about 100, 110 pages, but it's his experience with cold fusion as well right after the Pons and Fleischmann discovery.
Oh, wow. I'm psyched and fascinated by this whole story, and I really appreciate you helping Dr. Judy Wood, and it's just a pleasure to get to talk with you, and I hope to have you back on the show, Russ.
Well, I'd love to anytime.
Thank you. Our guest, Russ Gerst, he is a CPA, like I said earlier, and he is a colleague of Dr. Wood's, and has helped her immensely with the publishing of her book. Russ, thank you so much for being on the show. And that'll do it for us on In Other News. We'll see you next week, 10 p.m.